Hey, you guys, what's going on?
Yeah. Talking
Oh
about a great movie today.
my God. It's a can I just say, if you guys can't see the chat, I laughed out loud when I saw what TB Driggers put. They put, "Hey guys, it seems to me beneath this waiting screen, there's something wonderful just waiting to get out," which is a reference to Boogie Nights. I laughed very, very hard when I saw that comment. So thank you very much for
Really good movie.
that.
I think it starts off supposed to be like with 77.
It does start in 1977,
77.
yeah.
California, Southern California area. I was about 8 years old at this time, and the porn industry. And it's loosely based on what some of the stuff that really happened in the porn industry, like John Holmes. It's called Boogie Nights. They
My God.
changed all the names to protect the innocent.
I love this movie
Good, yeah, it's a good
so
movie.
much.
It's aged very well. What year did this come out?
97.
97. It's aged very well.
You know what's funny? I saw this movie. It's directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, and who made this when he was 26 fucking years old. I can't he had made actually he made a short film when he was 17 that was kind of like a mockumentary that was sort of based on John Holmes, but it was called The Dirk Diggler Story. And that this is like his feature-length version of that. So he'd been kicking around this idea for a long time. I saw this in the theater in 1997 and I fucking loved it. And I distinctly remember going to the bathroom afterward, and there was this old lady in, she was at the sink next to me, and she looks to me and she goes, "Did you know that movie was gonna be like that?" I guess she didn't know it was about porn. It was an old lady. And I was like, "Do you guys like not read the plot synopsis like
No.
before you go see a movie
No,
or
old people will
what?"
see a random movie.
They'll just be, they don't have anything better to do, I guess.
They'll see me.
She was like, yeah, so, well, I don't know. I just thought that was
I
really
remember
funny.
watching Prometheus. There was an old couple in front of me, and when that shit was over, the dude goes, "What was that about?" This is I would say the highlight of this movie in terms of just like this movie is a monument to Burt Reynolds. This is his best movie.
He got an Oscar nomination for
Oh, he
this.
did? Yeah, well, I'm telling
I
you.
don't know if he, I don't think he won, but he got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, Reynolds knocks it out of the fucking park
He
in
is
this
so good
movie.
in this.
Really, really good in it. Everybody in it is really good. Mark Wahlberg's really good in it. Just everybody is good in this movie. Nina Hartley has a fucking cameo in it. If you haven't heard,
Yeah.
she's an old school fucking porn star. It's just a good movie. It's a good story about friends in a scene and how fucking they kind of came from nothing and made a living for themselves and how they were kind of dumb, but that's just the way it is, you know? And then it kind of turns dark for a while, but then they kind of take care of each other. And some of the people that, turns out were, involved in some bad shit with little kids and shit, and they got locked up for it. And what happened to that dude? He got beat up in jail, beat up in prison.
It's kind of like a standard rise fall redemption story. And I've seen a couple, there's some really good videos like analyzing this movie, and in particular comparing it to Goodfellas, which you wouldn't really think about,
It is
but
like that.
it is a lot like Goodfellas.
Very similar tone.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson is a big fan of Martin Scorsese, so you could see like he was making some homages to it, like in the movie.
It's the Goodfellas of the porn world.
Yeah,
That's what they're talking about.
because it's like it's something that's, it was porn was legal, but there was like other illegal shit going on too. So it's almost kind of like has a little bit of a a parallel to the gangster world.
Yeah, porn was going on, but there was a lot of illegal drugs. There was just people losing custody of their children and all the ramifications of being a porn star. Like you couldn't really borrow any money from the bank and because they thought you would just fucking make porn with
Make
it.
more porn.
And so it's just kind of funny, But good story, real good story.
I mean, this is just it's a great ensemble piece. Also, I think something else that I saw pointed out that was again kind of similar to Goodfellas was that the theme of this was, despite all the porn and all the drugs and shenanigans, the theme was people finding a family. You know what I mean? Because it was almost kind of like, I mean, Dirk Diggler, nominally the main character, coming from a really terrible household. Like his mom is just this drunk that just tells him how stupid he is all the time. And then
Yeah, and
his
there's
dad is just kind of like over it and is just like, "I'm not even getting involved anymore."
yeah, his dad's kind of like giving up.
Yeah, he should, well, you
I
know.
kind of fucking detected that there was something going on with the mom. The mom was fucking kind of jealous of the son in certain ways.
Well, she was a drunk too.
She didn't want him dating girls and shit. It was just some weird shit going on there.
It might have been. Yeah. I mean, you know, they didn't really, this doesn't really hit on it. Yeah. But
was there some kind of abuse going on there?
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Because, I mean, the, you know, Dirk Diggler, who's, you know, his real name is Eddie in the movie, is Eddie Adams. Yeah. But since he's so cock-centric, I mean, that's his one special thing.
That's the only thing he
has. Is his big, huge dick.
Yeah.
Maybe the mom wants to jump on it.
Yeah. Or maybe was.
Or maybe was jumping on that. And now he's like, you know, now he's grown and he's like not taking it anymore.
Right.
But I mean, it's so all of these people, and I think it's implied too that Roller Girl, played by Heather Graham, they don't really show her home life, but it is kind of, they show her in school, like in high school, and how everybody's like kind of picking on her because I guess everybody's sort of.
Well, some of them knew that they were porn stars.
Yeah, some of them knew that she was in porn.
That sounds like, though? That's kind of like a ripoff of the girl that ended up being later on in. Crybaby.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Oh, shit, man. That just went right out of my head.
Crybaby. She was
Tracy Lords.
Tracy Lords. I think they're kind of saying that she was like a... But Tracy Lords wasn't around in the 70s. That was 80s.
Yeah.
Maybe very late 70s, but it's probably what they're talking about.
All the characters in this are fantastic. Yeah. And I love the way... I mean, it's almost kind of like... So the first part of it is almost like funny. Because like I said, it's sort of like... It's a comedy drama, I guess, if you want to put it like that. And the first half of it, which is kind of like Dirk's rise to fame and him getting everything that he wants, almost like a fairy tale type of thing. And everything is going well. But even though everything's going well and it's like a big party and shit, there's still like little clues kind of threaded throughout that shit's going to like crash and burn later on. You know what I mean? It's like really subtle shit like... you know, the one where Amber Waves, played by Julianne Moore, like where she gets that phone call at the party and, you know, it's her kid calling and she misses it because nobody knows what her real name is. You know, that really little skinny girl like ODing at the party. Yeah. And everyone being kind of, I love that when they show up at the party, the first thing she asks, you got any Coke at this party?
Yeah. And they got one of the guys who's in the crew. I think he does lighting or something having to do with on the film crew.
Yeah.
And, his wife keeps showing up to all the damn parties. She's not a porn star, but she's screwing all the people. Screwing them all in public and shit in front of him. And every time he's turning around, he's finding his fucking wife having sex in front of everybody at the party.
And he's like, go away.
You know that shit's going to go bad. That ends up going bad.
Well, I feel like because the cool thing, I like the transition between... everything being awesome and like a big party, which it kind of was like in the 70s. And then it culminating at that New Year's party where it's 1980 now.
Yeah.
And it's video New Year.
Was taking over.
Yeah. There's all these changes in the air, like videos taking over, like amateur porn stars, like more that kind of thing. Like it was more cheaply produced.
Yep.
And, you know, and at that party, that was where, you know, he shot his wife and then shot himself. And that kind of signaled the beginning of, you know, the party's over now kind of thing.
Yeah, it just, porn went from like something kind of like mimicking Hollywood. It went from that to becoming basically a machine because that's what, the guy was no longer really a director. He was just a business owner and they would just use videotape, which is real cheap and you don't need big crews and you don't even need porn stars. You just use hiring new talent all the time. The numbers of them expanded. You know, there weren't many porn stars in the 70s. There was a shit ton of them in the 80s and the 90s. And they were only around a couple of years and then they were gone. They didn't make much money. They made some, but not a whole lot. And it just became a machine, not really a fucking artistic
endeavor. Yeah, it wasn't about quality anymore. You could argue that, like, you know, it was never about quality. It was just about, like, people getting off. But I think one of the points of this movie... And the reason why Burt Reynolds' character Jack Horner was such a sympathetic character was because yes, he was making porn.
He thought it was art.
And and yes, it was terrible. Like you see, this is a giant cock. You know what I mean? It's just like all this kind of terrible acting.
Yeah.
Which is, I love the way, like when you're a really good actor, you can play a bad actor in a movie. You know what I mean? Like really well. But they did that really well.
Right.
But I think like he really had a dream that he wanted to make a really good porn movie. Because he even says, like, during that diner scene where it's like they're sitting around.
He gives a strategy. It's ridiculous.
Saying it's like once they've jerked off, I want them just like sit there stewing in it because they can't leave because they want to see what happens at the end.
Yeah, I don't want them getting
story.
Up and leaving the theater. They were doing this in the theater. Just another era, man. Remember there was a fucking funny Cheech and Chong skit. They fucking go into the porn theater together and he sits down and fucking Cheech goes, oh, what's this? Oh, come, let's go. Their feet were fucking sticking to the ground as
well,
they're walking.
Very sticky, those porn theater.
I don't understand how they could fucking go into that shit, man. Just, the motherfuckers were hardcore.
Perverted. Well, don't think about all the diseases that you're probably exposing yourself to just by going into this place. I remember I grew up in Daytona Beach, and when I was a kid, I remember there being a porn theater on Ridgewood Avenue. I never went in there, obviously, because I was little, but I remember seeing the marquee.
Yeah, well, they showed the Pussycat Theater. That's in Long Beach. That was near where I lived.
Yeah.
You could walk to there from where I lived for a little while when I was in military school. I can't remember the name of the fucking street that we lived on. We had a little apartment there for a while.
Yeah.
That was before we went to Brazil. Yeah, I remember. The thing is, it's like that was just like a normal thing. It was on. That was like downtown and like a big part of the scene, big part of the scenery of California.
Yeah.
Like porn.
Well, it's an iconic
porn films, porn
sign and like shit like that. Because I remember seeing it in movies and shit like that too.
Yeah, it was icon at the time. There's a big hotel across the street. Look like a gigantic, tall castle, like 20 stories tall, maybe. I don't know if that's still there anymore. I probably tore it down.
Yeah.
It was some kind of an office building, I think.
Tila was saying this is probably one of her top five favorite movies ever. Amanda was saying her favorite scene was the one where Roller Girl kicks the shit out of that dude on the ground like a limousine. I actually like that scene too. So I really like how everything is kind of idyllic at the beginning. Because like I said, that's kind of what it was like in the 70s. You know, there were porn stars. They were making actual films. You could make a shit ton of money doing it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a stigma about it. But, you know, they didn't really care. It was kind of like a big party. And like I said, it was almost kind of like an extended family.
Oh, hold on one second.
What's that?
Tila, I was rewatching Omega Man right now. I had to pause it. That shit is so fucking awesome. Because I got it on I got it on DVD. And watching it now, that's very relevant to today. The family is basically Antifa. You'll see. Exactly the same thing, destroying the past, and it's good. It's good. The bio warfare and plague, you'll see. But yeah, you need to watch that one. Okay, go ahead.
I forgot
what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. So basically, we talked about this because we did a show about the Wonderland murders. And the scene in this, which a couple of people have brought up already, because, you know, the drug dealer scene with Alfred Molina with the Night Ranger song and the Rick Springfield song and everything, which is probably one of the best scenes in this movie, is actually partially based on that, where like the gang, you know, after Dirk Diggler and his two buddies are, you know, they become drug addicts. They've lost most of their money. You know, they got kind of kicked out of Jack Horner's studio because of their coke fueled rages. And so they decide they're going to rob this drug dealer. And then they go there and it's just, I love the way that fucking thing is shot, because it's just kind of like, you know, the music is really loud. Alfred Molina is being all like fucking happy and singing along and everything. And then he's got that kid Cosmo that it's like throwing the firecrackers. It's like the three guys are like sitting on the fucking couch and they're all like freaking out, 'cause they're all nervous, 'cause they're trying to scam the dude. And it's just like this really, really great, like fucking tense scene. But what?
Oh, nothing. The comments. He said that they watched it last night, Omega Man. They loved it.
Movie.
Yeah, it's very relevant to what's going on right now. I love it. I was watching it. I was going, man, it's fucking awesome. This movie's awesome. Aged very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Louis said there was a Pussycat Theater by where I lived. All I remember, it smelled awful when I used to when I used to go by it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Probably.
I'm sure.
Imagine if it was your job to clean that place up.
Well, I'm saying it was somebody's job.
Yeah.
That's got to be like low part of the fucking totem pole, man. Gross.
Yeah.
But it's just so funny because, I mean, they got the soundtrack for this is fantastic. Everybody in this is fantastic. Like I said, even though Dirk Diggler is kind of like the focus and, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on around him, but, you know, there's a lot of main characters in this. I mean, can we talk about like fucking Don Cheadle as, you know, as Buck, like the guy that works in the stereo store?
Yeah, that was my favorite, one of my favorite characters out of this.
He's so good at this.
He was the most sympathetic of all the characters.
Yeah, he was just a really nice
dude.
He
was trying to make something out of himself, you know, with wanted his own store to, you know, selling electronics. And he was mostly bullshitting about knowing electronics, but he had passion behind electronics. Yeah. And he gets fucked over, but he does meet a good woman and hooks up with this blonde chick. She gets pregnant. And I thought he was going to get killed in the end, but he didn't. He came up. An opportunity fucking came up, and he took the money and fucking got the fuck out of there.
I mean, I love the scene where he's trying to sell that guy the stereo.
Yeah.
And he's like telling him all the stuff, and the guy the guy seems like he's kind of like, okay, you know, maybe. And then he puts the 8-track in there, and it's a doing 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 doing. And then he's like, "Go ahead, move if you have to," and shit. And the guy's like, "Yeah, bye."
Yeah. He fucked the sale up. And the guy who owned the store, he said, "What kind of brother are you?" Country Western music.
Well, because
he was wearing country clothes and shit. He goes, "It's coming back. It's coming back." No, it's not coming back.
He was, well, the thing that was
Cowboy, I think, is what he.
Yeah, the thing about it was that
Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah, because that other woman that works on the movie, she's like, you know, this look, it's like 5 or 6 years ago or whatever. Yeah, so I guess it was like from a long time ago. Yeah. And he's like, "What? You can't tell me about my look. What about your look?" She's like, "I have a look."
Then he reappears.
Chocolate Love.
Then he reappears later on in a fucking Rick James outfit, like a prototype Rick James from outer space and shit.
And he's looking all bummed out, like, at the party.
Yeah, it didn't work either.
Well, I think the reason that he's probably one of the most sympathetic characters, and everybody in this is sympathetic, even if they're fuck-ups, but he's the most sympathetic because you can tell that he's, like, a really good-hearted person, and he's trying to find an identity. Like, he feels like he doesn't fit in anywhere.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to
make a name for
carve out a place for himself.
Yeah.
So I think it's, like, really cool at the end. I mean, the one scene where, you know, his pregnant wife is in the car and he stops at the donut shop and, like, goes in to get the donuts. Yeah. And that's, like, such a great scene because, I mean, even when he's just there picking out the donuts, and it's a long scene. Like, he's just there and he's like, "Oh, are those for Christmas? That's cute." And it's, like, all this other kind of stuff. And then just, like, the tension builds up. Because you hadn't seen it in a long time.
I thought he was going to get killed.
So you thought he was going to get killed. But that's not how it goes. Like, yes, the place does get robbed, but everybody else gets killed. And then he gets all the money. And he's just kind of like,
the money laying there.
Doop. You know what I mean?
The business owner was dead. He didn't need the money.
That's what I'm saying. Hey,
and he had a baby on the way.
Yeah. And he wanted to open his own store, and he got to. So he got his own.
He got out of the born business.
And if you notice, too, in that scene, like, he's not wearing, like, a silly costume in that one. He just kind of looked like a normal dude.
Yeah, so he became a normal guy.
He just became a normal, like, he kind of, like, came into his own identity, which I thought was really nice. Because I feel like everybody got, as dark as this movie goes, I mean, it does go pretty dark. It's still funny, but, like, in a blackly humorous kind of way. Because, like, you know, people get fucking shot and killed, you know, and all this terrible stuff happens.
Yeah.
But pretty much everybody gets a little bit of redemption at the end. Except for the dude, except for the colonel, who was a child pornographer, so fuck him.
Yeah. Now, if you if you like this movie and you have not seen Mope, you are fucking up. Mope
because it explores a similar
in a way, but it gets pretty dark, but it's still a cool movie, and it's based in something that actually happened, based on two dudes who tried to become porn legends and fucking that's not what happened to them. But see Mope, MOPE.
Yeah,
really good.
I mean, you can tell that it was really influenced by Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
But that's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing.
I mean, that's not a bad thing.
It's taking place in the 80s though.
Yeah, it's a different era.
Yeah.
I feel like the best thing about this, I mean, the production design of this, you really feel like it's the fucking 70s, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really did a good job with, like,
the production design, the
interiors of the houses, the fucking soundtrack is so awesome.
That's the way California looked when I was a kid.
Everything about this is good. I love the opening scene where they introduce, because I was watching a video that was kind of like analyzing the opening scene, which is only, I think it's only like 3 minutes long, but it's that long tracking shot through the nightclub. And they introduce a lot of the main characters, and they don't even have to have like a lot of dialogue or anything like that. Just the way they interact with one another, like, just tells the viewer, like, immediately what the relationships between the people are. And it's just like really, really well done.
You know, growing up half the time in Long Beach, California in the 70s, you know, I left in, I think in 81 is when I left, maybe 82. The newer houses and the newer locations, the interiors looked like in this movie, it all looked like something out of a goddamn Love Hotel. It was fucking tacky. Tacky as shit. But you didn't know it was tacky. But it just looked like a fucking, it looked like a fucking orgy was going to break out at any fucking minute. You go to the house
party.
You go into these houses, they had these huge roofs, the fireplace was damn in the living room almost, and just weird shit, and it was just like big old fucking huge furniture. Everything looked like you could have sex on it. It did. Like the fucking chairs were big enough for fucking three people could get in them. The fucking sofas were giant. Fucking everything had looked like water beds. You had water beds and everything, and fucking beads and shit hanging down in between the doorways. And yeah, it looked like what you see it in this movie. That's the way it shit looked in the nice houses. Fucking, it was tacky. It was fucking tacky.
Nobody thought it was tacky at the time.
No, at the time you thought the shit was cool as shit. It was like something out of fucking Fantasy Island or the Love Boat or something. You know what I mean? That was like high tech shit. You know, I was like, oh, this is fucking great. But you look at it now. You go, yeah, it looks like some people are going to fuck. That's what it looks like. Looks like something from a porn flick.
Which maybe, I mean, just the whole kind of vaguely sleazy.
Yeah, sleazy. Everything like, kind of had like a sleazy sexual overtone to it. Like, why the fuck do you need a fucking couch that fucking goes up into the corner and then turns a corner and comes out and it's 5 feet fucking thick and it's only fucking 17 inches off the ground? You could fucking sleep like 9 people on this fucking thing.
And all the carpets were shag.
Carpets were shag. Shit went outside the walls. And you had beads and shit. And fucking lamps that touched the ceiling went all the way down. And you might have fucking a bunch of projectors on it. And then you'd have like a chandelier hanging. And it would be like a fuck. Inside the chandelier, it would actually be like a Greek statue with fucking little fishing line that went all around it, and oil would drip down it. It was just the tackiest.
I remember
those. Those things? Just tacky.
But the thing
shit.
About some of the
everything
shit.
Everything lucite and shit. Colored lights on.
Yeah, see, but I'm going to say that, like, particularly in this, I love the interior design of Jack Horner's house, like the party house, because a lot of shit takes place in there. And, you know, I could do without like the faux stone on the walls and stuff. Yeah. I know that was all the rage, like among like kind of upper middle class people back then. But some of the like hanging lamps and stuff, I love those colored bead, like those colored lucite, like hanging lamps. I love those. I would still have those in my house nowadays. Yeah. So some of the shit from the 70s, yeah, is super tacky.
Or Zero Dawn says, yeah, it was like living in the banana split. Exactly. She knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Zach said, I think the 80s were uglier though. I would agree with you on that. Yeah. I didn't like.
It went the opposite direction. Real minimal, simplistic shit.
Everything was
Patrick
like.
Patrick Nagel's fucking chrome and glass.
Everything was chrome and glass
and square
and beige.
Yeah, yeah.
And gray.
Gray.
And pink.
And, yeah.
Like a pale pink.
Exactly. Yeah.
And coral.
Teal looking fucking.
And teal.
Yeah. It had to try
and
to
triangular
atone for that banana splits look for fucking, you know, of the 70s. It tried to go in the opposite direction. Patrick Nagel fucking prints everywhere.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, yeah, I remember my best friend in high school had a bunch of those on her wall.
Right.
But because Duran Duran, that was the cover of Rio. Patrick Nagel did the cover of Rio. But I mean, if I had to pick, but of the aesthetic, I would definitely pick the 70s because the 80s. I mean, certain subcultures in the 80s, obviously, like I like the goth and death rock thing, but it's like the mainstream shit from the 80s, super ugly. Mm-hmm. I didn't like that real corporatist, beige, minimalist kind of shit.
You're asking about the 90s. The 90s was more 80s. You can go back and look at 90s stuff.
90s, but with...
Yeah, it looked 80s.
It's weird because the 90s kind of went in a way where it's like you kind of had one faction going in like a grunge direction.
Yeah.
So kind of back into like punk rock kind of and hippie kind of shit. And then the other way they went like ultra neon, like almost a 60s throwback. Like everything was like neon colors, this big like backwards pants. Remember all that kind of shit. So it was all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like the 90s maybe, I don't know, maybe didn't have as distinctive a style as the 80s or the 70s. It did, but.
And some 90s hair started to kind of look 70s and 80s again. It's just funny. Poofy looking hair. It's weird. Yeah. You can go back and look on YouTube. You can see old stuff from the 80s. Go look at malls. Like any footage of fucking malls that was taken in the 80s and the 90s. 90s malls, like from the VHS. People had VHS cameras. It's still around. You'll see what people were wearing as they were walking around in the malls. It kind of vaguely still looked 80s to me. And I see it now. We didn't think it looked 80s in those days. But you look at it now, there wasn't enough difference.
Zach was like, I can't even think of what the 2000s were doing. That's what I mean. I feel like as...
I actually like the 2000s.
Well, I feel like as subcultures have become more diffused, I feel like there's not... You don't have that iconic look from a decade anymore.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, there's trends. But shit, man, like, I even look every now and then, because, you know, like I said, I was trained as a graphic designer, so every now and then I'll be like, what are the design trends for this year? And there's always kind of, like, 10 of them.
Yeah.
It's never just, like, one thing.
Mid to late 90s, the girls' fashions looked great, I thought. They had some good shit during... I just liked that look. Even some of the raver-type clothes, like JNCOs and shit. Some of these girls are wearing JNCO pants, fucking belly shirts, and fucking... piercings in their fucking bellies and weird shit that I thought looked good. But then they had 90s goth clothes, like what you would see in Ginger Snaps. That looked good. Once they became...
Yeah, I liked that look.
Once they became werewolves and shit. Yeah, so it looked good.
There was some 90s shit. Like I said, more a subcultural
thing. Subcultures knew what they were doing, not the mainstream.
The mainstream kind of said... When I think of 90s mainstream fashion, I think of, like, Vanilla Ice.
Yeah.
You know what I'm like? Like that, where everything had like neon colored squiggles and shit like that on it.
Look at what Strawberry Switchblade was, Switchblade Symphony. Yeah. Look at what Switchblade Symphony was wearing, and just Google images. And that was 90s kind of goth / trip hop kind of. I like that.
Yeah.
Look good.
But yeah, so I mean, one of the things, I don't know, I love the clothes in Boogie Nights are good because they evoke the 70s, but they don't, like, draw a lot of attention to themselves. Because I feel like sometimes movies that are set in the 70s, you know, sometimes the costume design will be just, like, a little bit too much. And, you know, because people are like, look how 70s the clothes are.
Yeah, like it's a costume.
Like it's a costume. I feel like they really did a good job of, like, the clothes just being, like, obviously 70s, but naturalistic. And it was more like, I mean, there's one scene early on, like, in the disco with John C. Reilly's character, Reed, and the shirt that he's wearing, my dad had that exact same shirt back in the 70s, so it's just kind of like, and I think the ugly silk ones that they bought, because remember Reed and Dirk bought the same shirt, and then Scotty, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, he bought the same one too, because he was trying to be as cool as them, and so they all three had that same ugly silk shirt on. I think my dad had one like that too.
Another good part of this movie is when Dirk Diggler's trying to record all that music, and everything that they're fucking singing is like, they go, yeah, that's what bad 80s fucking...
Do you know what song that was? It was bugging me because I was like, I know I've heard this song somewhere else.
1984.
No, it was...
What was it?
The song they were singing in the thing. That was the song from the fucking animated Transformers movie from the 80s.
I forgot about it.
You got the touch. I didn't really, but because I saw the movie again, because I've seen it a few times, and I saw it again last night, and I was like, I know that song from somewhere else, and 80s, that's 80, where it's from. It's the 80s Transformers.
80s metal lyrics. Some of them were good, you know, like Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, they were the masters of fucking 80s metal lyrics, but most 80s metal sucked because the guys that wrote that shit could not grasp anything that was abstract. They had to spell out everything that they were fucking talking
everything
about.
Was just so on the nose.
It's just like this, not artistic at all, you know. He's telling the fucking story. And she wakes up in the morning, and she puts on her shoes. Then she gets in her Mustang. Dude, what the fuck are you talking about? And then she drives over to her friend's house. You know, it's just like, fucking, dude, what were you telling? It's terrible. But her daddy keeps on hitting her. Man, we gotta, like...
It's very literal.
Yeah, literal shit. Nothing abstract.
Everything was very literal.
That was why when fucking Skinny Puppy hit the fucking scene in Bauhaus and shit, they was all real abstract. What the fuck's he talking about? White on white, translucent black capes? Back on the rack? What the fuck? The virginal brides file past his tomb? What?
Well, I mean, they are talking about something literal, but they're saying it like
in a poetic sort of way. You know what I mean?
And some of their lyrics were very abstract. in a sense that they could mean lots of different things.
Well, Skinny Puppy lyrics, I heard that it was a couple of paragraphs that they would cut the sentences out apart and then cut words out of the sentences and then take that and throw it in a hat and kind of pull it back out and randomly put those phrases in something that was
like those poem magnets. Like,
that's how they made those lyrics. And it was very expressive. If you guys never heard Skinny Puppy, check out old Skinny Puppy, like Bites and Remission. That's a good album. What was the other one? Mind the Perpetual Intercourse. That was a good one. I like that one.
Mago said, did Tom write lyrics for Motley Crue?
It sounds like Motley Crue had the worst lyrics of all time. Worst lyrics. Especially later on. The first couple albums, the lyrics weren't that bad, but they just kept getting worse.
I don't mean to cast aspersions because sometimes, you know, simple lyrics are fine. Like I said, I like a lot of old, like, rockabilly and stuff like that, which those lyrics are just very simple and very straightforward. Yeah. You know, and look at somebody like the Ramones or somebody like that, which is, like, simple, straightforward. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just kind of like, I do feel like, I think that got its worst, you know, it kind of came to its worst thing, like, during the 80s metal phase, like you said, because they couldn't just be like, oh, let's do a simple Baby I Love You type song.
No.
They had to, like, take it to an excess, but make it even more literal, and that made it, like, lamer.
Yeah, they had to be teaching you something about history, or they had to be fucking talking about something that happened in the skies above London, or some shit like that during the fucking, you know what I mean? Oh, we're going to take it back to the honky motherland, during the time that fucking Napoleon was fucking marching against the Russians, and it was all this literal stuff, you know? Each song was about something, and it wasn't personal. It was something like historical.
Yeah.
Iron Maiden basically made 4 or 5 albums talking about books that Steve Harris read.
Yeah.
That every one of them was about a book he read or a movie he saw.
Kind of like the Misfits.
You got a song about Conan.
Every single Misfits song was about a horror movie that they saw.
Yeah.
And he's just describing what happened in the movie.
Read a book, read Dune. Going to write a song about Dune. That's a great song, though. I like the Peace of Mind album.
The thing about it, though, is that you can make lyrics that are... Because I think that's why writing lyrics and writing poetry and stuff like that is so hard, is because you want to talk about something specific, something relatable, but you have to make it vague or broad enough that everybody can cast their own kind of thing into it. And I get what you're talking about, or this is what I think they're talking about. You have to make it universal, but also specific, which is really difficult to do in such a limited time frame.
What the best of metal lyrics were the 70s. That was 70s Judas Priest. And fucking very late 70s, early 80s, Iron Maiden. The first two albums, Iron Maiden and Killers. The Paul Di'Anno. Paul Di'Anno was really the best vocalist for Iron Maiden. Oh, even though I love Bruce Dickinson. You know, he had a lot of good albums. I like both of them, but Paul just... It was a very hot and dirty kind of punk rock metal sound. I just liked it. And it was just visceral. It didn't really have... It was, like I said, it was more abstract and artistic. It wasn't about aces high and fucking fighter planes over the fucking, you know, Battle Britain. And it wasn't about all that historical shit. It was just about dudes killing chicks because he's a fucking weirdo. Or I'm a ghost now and I'm watching you, you know? Yeah. They made a song called The Twilight Zone. And a dude died, and he's watching his girlfriend, and he's fucking missing her, and he's thinking, I think I'm going to do something to you so you can join me on the other side. Imagine that. But it's very vague.